anthropologist Richard Nelson spent years in the North living with and studying among Native Americans, but he spent the last few years exploring an island near his home in the Pacific Northwest. His book, The Island Within, is an account of his exploration. As he describes it, the island is big and mountainous, covered with forest and swamp-like meadows. Deer, mink, and brown bears are among the inhabitants. No people live on the island, but during World War II it was a military station, and rotted Quonset huts are the only reminder that other people were once there. In the preface to The Island Within, Nelson writes, "As time went by, I realized that the particular place I'd chosen was less important than the fact that I'd chosen a place and focused my life around it." I asked him how long it took him to realize that.
Oh, it took me quite a while. You know, after I'd been around the island for, a couple of years, I suddenly realized that I could think about this place as something special and maybe the most beautiful and wonderful place in the world, but then I realized that wasn't true at all, that every place in the world is as special as every other place, and what makes this one special for me is the relationship that I have to it, that it's my home. And I think it's a real important, it was a really important insight for me to recognize that any of us can have the same relationship to the place where we live. We just need to try to be there attentively and paying attention and loving the place.
Was this a particularly important realization for you because you'd spent so much time living in other people's homes and other people's territories as an anthropologist?
Oh, definitely. You know, you're in someone else's culture and in someone else's community. You never feel that you really belong there. You may be welcome there, and people are very kind to you. But I think it develops in you a deep yearning to have a home and to know that you belong there and to know that it's your place on earth. Especially because, for example, having lived with Native American people, they are so deeply rooted in their home, going back generation upon generation upon generation, living always in the presence of their ancestors and drawing on the knowledge of those ancestors. You begin to realize that we in Western culture have lost this deep sense of rootedness, not irretrievably. Of course, what drives me, I think, right now is a sense that we can regain this belonging and this home.
You talk about establishing a moral contract with the world. Elaborate on that.
Well, I learned about living in a sort of a moral, spiritual relationship to nature from elders of the Koyukon Athabascan Indians, whom I lived among for a couple of years. And for those people, everything in the natural world has a spirit, and everything is conscious and aware, so that if you're standing next to a tree, it knows you're there. And if you mistreat an animal, it becomes offended by this. Well, I never knew if this was literally true. I never knew if the spirit was really in things. But there seemed to be a deeper wisdom in that a person should behave as if it is, whether you know or not. And I think it's something that can apply to any of us. So I've tried to follow the Koyukon people's way of respecting animals, just as one way out of many, and think that people could choose their own gestures of respect toward nature as a constant reminder of where their life comes from and of the fragility of the earth and the need to treat the earth carefully.
Now, within this moral contract with the world, you hunt, and one of the animals you hunt is deer, and you're really in awe of deer. Is this a contradiction?
Well, I don't think so. I grew up in Wisconsin being opposed to hunting. I thought hunting was wrong and immoral. I learned how to hunt from Eskimo people in northern Alaska, and so it came to me as a way to make a living, not as a sport or recreation. And I found, especially living with Koyukon people, where this religious tradition is so intertwined with a hunting life, that there are ways of taking other lives and doing it with respect and humility. And I think each of us lives only at the behest of other lives. Even if we're vegetarians or whatever it is that we eat, it comes only from the earth, all of it. And so I think there's a special richness in being responsible for taking that life that gives you your own life.
So how did you go about hunting deer, taking this into account?
Well, when I hunt, I try to be mindful that as Koyukon people would say, that the animal knows way more than you do, that you have to talk respectfully about it. If I'm going hunting, I don't say that's what I'm going to do. I just say I'm going to go out and look around. And then if I happen to get an animal, I always say thank you to the animal, and I always treat whatever parts of the animal I don't use carefully. I don't just throw things in the garbage. I take them back, like the bones, I always take back to the island and leave them there. Any parts that I don't use, I say, well, these are for the other animals. I should say that in doing these sorts of things, I'm not trying to imitate Native American people or to pretend that I am one. I'm trying to see if there's a universal wisdom here that applies to myself as a comfortably practicing member of my own Euro-American culture. If those principles can apply to me, then I feel, well, they can apply to any of us, to all of us, perhaps.
And what conclusion are you reaching?
Well, I guess what I think is that Native American people lived on the North American continent for thousands and thousands and thousands of years and did it in such a way that when the first Europeans arrived here, they mistakenly began calling it a wilderness. It was so pristine and so rich that it was hard for them to imagine anyone had ever lived here. And in thousands of years, I think that the Native American people developed an earthbound wisdom that is really, really so significant that we might do well to start trying to learn from it.
You write that in spite of all your contact with Native peoples that you've remained an agnostic.
Yes, I haven't tried to achieve some kind of orthodoxy in Native American beliefs. I just think that these principles are so wise and so profound and such good reminders to us of where our lives come from that they're worth following. You don't have to adopt some kind of a deep religious faith to do it. You just have to see that this is a wise way to live.
How do you make a living?
Well, such as it is, sometimes I teach, most recently at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I do little research projects on contracts. But when I was working on this book, which took years, I wrote full-time for 18 months, and I spent about 3 years on the island and worked from about 2,000 pages of journal material when I did the book. During most of that time, my partner, Nita, worked to support the research and the writing.
Ah, okay. In part of your book, you describe exploring Kluxa Mountain, which is on the island that you've been exploring, and during this time, your partner was away with her dying mother, dying of cancer. And I was wondering if you felt maybe that you were kind of out of balance emotionally at that point, seeking solitude and understanding the island while, you know, someone in your family was really ill.
It was a very difficult time. I was staying at home because our son was in school, and so Nita had to be with her mother, and I had to be home. It was kind of the way we divided the duties at that time.
I see.
But to be going out and having these adventures and these great times while other people were away amid such suffering was very difficult. But my time on the island ended up being just critical for me to try to come to grips with the death that was happening in our family. And I suppose in the long run, that was the most important thing that came for me out of this island experience, was a much better sense of what life and death meant for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried that with the writing of your book, The Island Within, that people will want to find this island that you consider so special?
Yes, that really concerns me. It seems to me that a lot of the nature and outdoor literature rests on a precarious balance between showing people where wonderful places are on the continent so people will care about keeping them in their wild state versus drawing crowds, such great crowds, to places that their specialness is destroyed. It's a balance that I have struggled profoundly with myself and have chosen to preserve the anonymity of the place out of a an ethical principle of respect toward it. Also, I think out of respect toward my readers, I think that everyone should have the same opportunity to discover this place as I discovered it and as many people discovered it before me. And so one thing I would really like to see is a consideration of this in the whole community of people who read and write nature literature, that we need to develop a way to care about places without necessarily destroying their anonymity.
Mm-hmm. So how have you tried to preserve the anonymity of the island?
Well, the main way I've done it is by not talking about where it is and by using place names that are not found on maps.
Mm-hmm.
Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Richard Nelson, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure.